dealt with stuff. Anybody all right. Coming, we're just coming in out as
a... That's fine. It's fine. Well, speaking of time pressures, I've left myself too much to do here. So this will be odds and ends and tag pieces. And in any case, we will wrap it up with this session. I wish I could do more with the four quartets. I'll make a few basic points, and then, as I said, I want to look at each of the four lyrics, all four of the part fours of each of the four poems. But let me tell you, this is, I don't think I've ever said this before publicly, and it's nothing to be ashamed of, but quite honestly, for decades, I mean decades, whenever I travel, I keep in my little shoulder bag a copy of the four quartets, so that if I'm stuck in an airport or if I'm bored on the flight, whatever, I can pull it out, and it is one of the best traveling companions possible. I also keep a little copy of the Psalms, so I have a sacred text to keep me going and a little secular text to keep me going. And I hate flying, and I'm not much of a... I'm a very bad traveler. I'm very happy to be here. But travel for me is an ordeal, but it's a great help. My point being, the four quartets can be a great friend and a great help. And the more you read them, the more friendly they become, and the more you will understand the mysteries and the beauties of them. They are remarkable poems. Now, I just discovered this recently. I'd known these poems forever, and discovered, just as the original title of The Wasteland was to be taken from Dickens, from our mutual friend. He knew the police in different voices. The original epigraph for the four quartets was supposed to be from Dickens as well, from the Pickwick Papers. As I said, the subject of the poems is really time, or the strange mystery that we live in, being human, between time and eternity, and what the relationship between those two things are. So what Eliot originally proposed, this is from near the end of Pickwick Papers. Mr. Pickwick is going to the Fleet Prison, and he's being assigned his room there. He's going there because of a so-called breach of promise suit that he actually wasn't responsible for. But sweet man that he is, he's taking his punishment as a man. And they're assigning him to his room. And he finds out there are other people in the room with him. One of them's a parson, said Mr. Roker. Another's a butcher. Eh? Exclaimed Mr. Pickwick. A butcher, repeated Mr. Roker. What a thorough-paced goer he used to be, surely. You remember Tom Martin, Nettie? Said Roker, appealing to another man in the lodge, who was paring the mud off his shoes with a 5-and-20 bladed pocket knife. I should think so, the party address said. Bless my dear eyes, said Mr. Roker, shaking his head slowly from side to side and gazing abstractedly out of the grated windows before him as if he were fondly recalling some peaceful scene of his early youth. It seems but yesterday that he whopped the coal heaver down Fox Under the Hill by the wharf there. I think I can see him now, a coming up the strand between the two street keepers, a little sobered by the bruising, with a patch of vinegar and brown paper over his right eyelid, and that ere lovely bulldog has pinned the little boy afterwards, a following at his heels. What a rum thing time is, ain't it, Nettie? That was going to be the original epigraph. What a rum thing time is, ain't it, Nettie? Instead, what Eliot finally decided was something a little more serious, and he took two quotations from Heraclitus, one being, the way up and the way down are the same, a mysterious paradox that he develops throughout the poems. The other being a very interesting one, which is simply, even though each man is possessed of the word, he thinks he has a personal word all his own. That is, we have certain things absolutely in common, but we presume each of us is unique in a very special way. But for the poems, another major theme is the word. How do you write? What does language mean? How can we keep language pure and honest? What happens when words are destroyed? The resolution for both of the major problems throughout the four quartets, and they're resolved, these themes and counter-themes are resolved as the poems progress. How do you reconcile our living in time with the fact that we know our souls are eternal? How do you reconcile time and eternity? Time being represented, especially in the dry Salvages, as the river, eternity being the sea. And for Eliot, there is only one possible reconciliation. As he says, the hint half guessed, the gift half understood, is incarnation. It's only in our Lord. It is only in the fact that God himself, the eternal God, became human and lived in time that we can possibly understand the reconciliation of the two. Outside of Christ, time and eternity cannot be reconciled. And if you refuse to accept our Lord as God, then you're either going to give up on eternity and not believe there's anything beyond the current miserable world we live in, or you're going to give up on the world and head off into a world, a land of abstraction, where you are not connected to reality at all. Without incarnation, time and eternity, and we are touched by both, cannot be reconciled. There is one other line that I think is crucial to understanding all the poems. Eliot says at one point, to be conscious is not to be in time. And it's the little moment I talked about in the last conference where that moment in the Rose Garden, when he's touring Burt Norton, he suddenly has this sense of moving above time, outside of time. He has a glimpse of something beyond time. But as we all know, those moments can only last for an instant and we're deposited back down into time. But we get these intimations. Wordsworth's phrase, the intimations of immortality. There's something more in us. We know there's something more in us. There's something higher for us. There is something eternal in us. We know that. But that only comes through intimations. That only comes in brief, brief moments. But what Eliot says is that the proof that it's there with us all the time is our consciousness. To be conscious is not to be in time. I find it fascinating that the one mystery of the human person that science cannot unravel and that they continue to argue about and that they keep trying to dismiss and they can't dismiss is what it means to be conscious. That little voice in your head that's running all the time, where you're always talking to yourself, where you have an awareness of things that is a personal awareness that is somehow outside of everything else around you, that in one sense makes you alone, but in another sense is there with you as a kind of consolation because you know it's always there. And here's the mystery of it. That consciousness does not age as we do. Our bodies may grow older. Our thoughts may grow more specific through time. We may gain understanding. But that consciousness we have, that little voice that runs in us, doesn't get any older. It doesn't age. And for Eliot, that consciousness is proof that we are not merely mortal, but creatures who are possessed of something higher beyond this, heading towards that goal of eternity. And it touches everyone in some way, and it baffles science. Baffles science. They cannot figure it out, which is a very, very good thing. Those are the themes running. And for him, of course, the personal, those four places that were of great importance for him during his life, coming to understand more of who he himself is, why he was here, what his duty as a poet is. All very interesting. I recommend you read the quartets aloud. Keep them with you. But as I said last night, the resolution for each of the quartets comes in part four, or the fourth movement. I'm just going to read a couple of them. I'll comment on a couple. But what you will find is, in each one of them, resolution is not possible without the faith. He may be asking philosophical questions about time, but there can be no resolution to the questions without faith. Specifically, the Christian teachings that help us understand these mysteries. Bert Norton, the first of the four quartets. Here's part four, the little lyric. Time and the bell have buried the day. The black cloud carries the sun away. Will the sunflower turn to us? Will the clematis stray down, bend to us? Tendril and spray clutch and cling? Chill fingers of you be curled down on us? After the kingfisher's wing has answered light to light and is silent, the light is still at the still point of the turning world. Question being, darkness comes, will nature just absorb us? Are we nothing more than that? And the answer comes very quickly, no, because just as the setting sun reflects off the kingfisher's wing, light from light. By the way, he takes that image from Gerard Manley Hopkins, Father Hopkins. It's a poem. And the kingfisher in Hopkins, and even before Hopkins wrote, has been an emblem of Christ. In any case, the light from heaven reflects off the kingfisher's wing, light to light. And after that has happened and is silent, the light is still. We may not see it anymore. The darkness may come, but the light is still there. The light is still. The light is always there at the still point of the turning world. The world is constantly spinning. Okay, we know that. It's constantly going around, but any globe that spins has a still point at its center. And that still point cannot move, will not turn, is always there. It's a wonderful little lyric. It's a wonderful little lyric that again begins to resolve some of the tensions in the poem. East Coker, where he goes back to where his family sailed from when they left England to come to America. Questions of the family inheritance, what had been handed down to him, what he had received from his family, and ultimately questions about original sin, his own guilt, the guilt he carries, the fallen world he lives in, generation after generation after generation, living, marrying, copulating, giving birth, dying, and then going under the earth. What does it all mean? Why is this sin passed down? How do we get out of it? How do we heal ourselves? This lyric is unbelievable. Oof, oof. East Coker, part four. The wounded surgeon plies the steel that questions the distempered part. Beneath the bleeding hands we feel the sharp compassion of the healer's art, resolving the enigma of the fever chart. Our only health is the disease, if we obey the dying nurse, whose constant care is not to please, but to remind of our and Adam's curse, and that to be restored, our sickness must grow worse. The whole earth is our hospital, endowed by the ruined millionaire, wherein, if we do well, we shall die of the absolute paternal care, which will not leave us, but prevents us everywhere. The chill ascends from feet to knees, the fever sings in mental wires. If to be warmed, then I must freeze and quake in frigid purgatorial fires, of which the flame is roses, and the thorns, and the smoke is briars. The dripping blood our only drink, the bloody flesh our only food. In spite of which we like to think we are sound, substantial flesh and blood. Again, in spite of that, we call this Friday good. I don't know what to say. It's clear who the wounded surgeon with the bleeding hands is. And it's very clear that his sharp compassion is to make us share his pain. It's, you know, our only health is the disease. We're corrupted creatures. Our health is in recognizing how sick we are, okay? But then it can only be our health if we obey the dying nurse, whose constant care is not to please but remind of our and Adam's curse. It goes all the way back to our first parents. And that to be restored, our sickness must grow worse. We better be prepared to suffer. It's through the suffering that we will ultimately be healed. It's an astonishing poem. An astonishing poem. Just beautifully. The Dry Salvages. Again, the water poem. Beginning with the Mississippi and then moving to Massachusetts and his boyhood days, the glories of the sea and the time he spent on the sea. And as I said last night, the fourth lyric here is an invocation, a prayer to Our Lady. Our Lady of Good Voyage, the chapel that stood on Cape St. Anne, the statue of Our Lady outside the chapel of Our Lady of Good Voyage, who overlooks the sea, who is above eternity, if you will, it's wonderful, who is there for all of those whose business has to do with the sea. Here's the lyric, the little prayer, part four, the Dry Salvages. Lady, whose shrine stands on the promontory, pray for all those who are in ships, those whose business has to do with fish, and those concerned with every lawful traffic, and those who conduct them. Repeat a prayer also on behalf of women who have seen their sons or husbands setting forth and not returning. Filia del tuo filio, Queen of Heaven. Also pray for those who were in ships and ended their voyage on the sand, in the sea's lips, or in the dark throat which will not reject them, or wherever cannot reach them, the sound of the sea bell's perpetual angelus. Pray for all those in ships, business having to do with ships, pray for the women who have seen sons or husbands going off and not returning. As the mother lost her son, pray for the women who are losing their sons or their husbands. And then a line from Dante, Filia del tuo filio. It comes from the last canto of the Paradiso. The very end of the Paradiso, where Dante the Pilgrim is granted a vision of the Blessed Mother in heaven. And Saint Bernard, who has led him through those final moments up to the ultimate vision, Saint Bernard prays to Our Lady and refers to her in the Italian as Filia del tuo filio, daughter of your son. It's a wonderful paradox, but of course it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. The Blessed Mother is the daughter of her own son. It's a glorious phrase. But what it does is the woman is mother, the woman is daughter, the woman loving her son, the son creating his own mother. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous phrase. But then, of course, the final Filia del tuo figlio, Queen of Heaven, because that's where Dante ultimately sees her, and that's where souls who make it may one day be granted the vision of that woman as well. And then, of course, those who have died ended their voyage in the sand, in the sea's lips, it's just, oof. Or in the deep throat, which will not reject them. They go down into the sea, and the sea will not spit them back out. It's the bodies, it's like Phlebas the Phoenician, just being washed endlessly there in the ocean. But wherever cannot reach them, the sound of the sea bells, perpetual angelus, those sea bells, the markers, that are constantly ringing. And what Eliot is saying is, that ringing of that bell in the sea is like the ringing of the angelus bell, reminding of us of eternity, but particularly the angelus, the moment of the incarnation, when our Lord was indeed conceived in the womb of the Blessed Virgin. And at that moment, time and eternity became one. At that time, the grave sorrow of life was finally healed. So in a way, this is a poem of sorrow and loss, but the glorious fact that that which is lost need not be lost. And it's thanks to that lady whose shrine still stands there on the promontory, looking out over all her children. It's a gorgeous lyric. It's a gorgeous lyric. And finally, Little Gidding. I have to take some time on this. It's, as I said last night, it's considered the greatest lyric poem of the 20th century. It's remarkable. Here we go. The dove descending breaks the air with flame of incandescent terror, of which the tongues declare the one discharge from sin and error. The only hope or else despair lies in the choice of pyre or pyre, to be redeemed from fire by fire. Who then devised the torment? Love. Love is the unfamiliar name behind the hands that wove the intolerable shirt of flame which human power cannot remove. We only live, only suspire, consumed by either fire or fire. It's very simple. It's extraordinarily complex. In part two of Little Gidding, and I'll mention it a bit later, Eliot is remembering his time as an air... The war is still going on. This was published in 1942. Eliot was an air raid warden. So when the sirens went off and everyone had to be inside and all the windows were blacked out, Eliot was walking the streets of London alone in the darkness, waiting for the bombs to fall. Those V-1 and V-2 rockets that came over London and then would suddenly drop and nobody knew where they would land. And indeed, when they came over, apparently, this is by report, I was not around yet and not in London, I didn't see it, there was a little bit of fire at the tail. So that you have the rocket come in, giving a little fire, it's bringing death and destruction, it drops somewhere, boom. And he refers to it as the dove. He equates it with Pentecostal fire, the tongues of fire, the little tongue at the back of the rocket. This might seem very strange, but please notice what that Pentecostal fire brought was the Holy Spirit. And what Eliot is saying is that we are once again being given a gift, that those rockets, those bombs falling on London are a gift from God. The dove descending breaks the air with flame of incandescent terror. Those waiting below, who apparently there was a sound, you could hear the sound of the rocket, and then it would stop. And that meant that that rocket was going to descend somewhere. And you didn't know if it was going to blow you up or not. And Eliot says, what a great gift from God. The war is still going on. He published this. Can you imagine? Flame of incandescent terror of which the tongues declare, the tongues of fire, we're back at Pentecost, declare what? The one discharge from sin and error. The modern world has become so sinful, the only way we can discharge ourselves from that sin and error is by being blown up, which will be a great gift from God. I mean, this is an extraordinary statement. And he's making it to a world that no longer believed much of anything. The only hope, or else despair, lies in the choice of pyre or pyre. You've got two choices. You can decide how you're going to be burned up. You can be burned up meaninglessly by the bomb blowing you up and it's all meant nothing. Or you can realize this is suffering sent by God. It's a great gift. And you put yourself on the pyre and say, God have mercy on me. God take me. I accept the suffering and death you have sent me. Those are the two pyres you can choose. Your flesh being burned up or the pyre of sacrifice where you offer yourself up. Lies in the choice of pyre or pyre to be redeemed from fire by fire. You make that offering, God forgive me, I take me, take all I am, burn me up. You might be saved from other fire, that later fire, that eternal fire, by accepting the fire in time that God has chosen to send. Because the fire is coming down from the sky and it may well land on you. And if so, be ready and accept it. Who then, he admits this. Who then devised the torment? Who did this? This is torment. What, I'm supposed to live my life waiting for the bomb to drop on me? That's torment. Why, yes it is. Have you heard of the cross? Yes. Torment at the end. Who then devised the torment? Love. Well, that's a strange way to show somebody that you love them. Well, only if you're stupid. Only if you have a sentimental view of love. Only if you don't understand that the ultimate love is suffering and sacrifice. That's how you show love. And that often, to show love, you must of necessity make others suffer and make sacrifices. And the ultimate gift of love comes from God above. Who then devised the torment? Love. Love is the unfamiliar name. We don't know what love is. We don't know. I mean, especially the modern world doesn't know what love is. Love is the unfamiliar name. Behind the hands that wove the intolerable shirt of flame that human power cannot remove. These bombs are falling down and we can do nothing about it. This war is going on and there is nothing. It will be God who will finally end it. Now there's also another, there's a whole other layer of imagery there. It comes from Greek mythology. Now I have to tell you a little Greek myth. So at the time of Hercules' wedding to Deianira, one of the centaurs carried off his wife after the wedding. And Hercules, needless to say, went chasing after his bride. Shot an arrow, killed Nessus the centaur. The centaur's dying, but as he's dying, the centaur says to Deianira, take a vial of my blood. And if you ever think your husband is falling out of love with you, all you have to do is somehow get that blood all over him and then he will love you again. Well, she fell for it. So she takes the vial of the blood and keeps it. And then sometime later, Hercules' eyes are wandering because he's met Miss Eyelashes and, the marriage was nice, but it's sort of been doing it for a while and one needs a little more excitement. After all, I'm Hercules, I'm the star quarterback. My wife's nice, but it's, hey, look at that out there, okay? So Deianira is aware that her husband may be about to wander and she has the vial of blood and she remembers what Nessus told her and she takes a shirt, one of his shirts, and a beautiful, no, it's she makes a beautiful new shirt for him and smears the blood all over the shirt and gives it to him. And Hercules puts it on and it bursts into flame. It's the center's revenge against Hercules. And once the flame in the shirt starts burning him, he cannot remove it. He cannot get the shirt off, and he knows this is the end. But it is so horrifying that he calls for a pyre to be built, because he'd rather burn up completely quickly than doing it this little bit at a time with the shirt burning him. So they build the pyre, and Hercules climbs on it, and they set it on fire, and Hercules and the shirt and the pyre all burn up. But even though he's done wrongs, he is partially forgiven, and he becomes half God and half mortal. He is welcomed onto Mount Olympus as a half-god. And what do we get? We get the man, the hero, and the god. And, of course, the story itself has all sorts of hints there I won't go into. You can figure them out for yourselves. And he burns up. And needless to say, Deianira feels a little abashed by it all. But please notice how it applies to this whole little second stanza. Who then devised the torment? Love. Love is the unfamiliar name. Behind the hands that wove the intolerable shirt of flame that human power cannot remove. We only live, only suspire, consumed by either fire or fire. We live our lives, we breathe the very air of life, either burning with passion that will destroy us in this world, or the fire sent by the Holy Spirit, which is divine love that makes us ready to sacrifice ourselves if God calls for it. And if the sacrifice involves fire falling from the sky as a punishment for sin, then we must accept it because we deserve it. It's our chance to unite our sufferings with our Lord's sufferings, and it will, in God's mercy, if we ask for it, perhaps free us from hellfire and send us to those other fires, those purgatorial fires, where at least when we're suffering, we know we will make it to heaven. I'll just say one word at this point, Akita. Fire will fall from the sky and 2/3 of the human race will be wiped out, and the living will envy the dead. The greatest poets are prophets. God will give great poets little prophetic glimpses. He wrote about World War II. I read it now, I think about World War III, or even beyond that, Akita. It's one reason to learn this little lyric and say it to yourself over and over, because I firmly believe it's our future, which we deserve. And it can give us some strength to go through it. Now, I'm going to tell you one other thing that's very strange. I'd known this poem, I'd taught it for years, and then suddenly it's in two stanzas. Each stanza has seven lines. 7 + 7 equals what? 14. What's a 14-line poem? It's a sonnet, a love poem. Eliot has taken the form of the sonnet, disguised it by breaking it into 7 and 7, and behind the poem, this rather stark, stern poem, is a love poem, the form of the ultimate love poem, a sonnet. Who then devised the lyric? Love. What is the poem? A sonnet. Love. Who then devised the torment? Love. And love is hidden behind everything, even the form of the poem. Whew. 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 What can one say? Oh, look at me talk on. Okay, I'm going to have to do this quickly. Published in 1942, after that he only published one other poem that I'll read to you a little later. That came in 1954. Then he turned his attention to the drama. He had written Murder in the Cathedral. He wrote another play after that in the 40s called The Family Reunion, contemporary setting. He gave a lecture called Poetry and Drama and said he cheated in his first two plays. Number one, it's very easy to write verse. It's right to write a play in poetry. As I said yesterday, if you set it back way back in time, because we think, oh, back then they talked poetry, so that's fine. Okay. In the family reunion, he has a contemporary setting. It's a family reunion. And he says he cheated there because he overdid the poetry. As he says in the Four Quartets and also in Murder in the Cathedral, humankind cannot bear very much reality. Well, he discovered human ears cannot stand very much poetry, especially from the stage. And he criticized his own play by saying, I put too much poetry in it. It is wonderful, but it is pretty rich. And as a result, by the way, there was a revival in London just a few years ago of the family reunion that got very good reviews. All of a sudden, people are starting to rediscover these plays and saying, gee, you know, we didn't think Eliot was much of a dramatist, but this is really pretty interesting. And why people started attending and talking about it and liking it. So as he said in his next play, called The Cocktail Party, 1949, he put his poetry on a very thin ration indeed. And many people who saw The Cocktail Party were not even aware it was in verse. They didn't know they were listening to a poetic drama. They had no idea, because it sounds like people talking. Well, it's the point I was making yesterday, that what he was seeking to do was find a language for poetry in our time that sounds like the way people actually talk. Now, what he was aware of, I'm just going to read some things. I don't think I'm going to do this right now. I'll just put it this way. In his prose writings, at the same time, he's talking about how civilization is disappearing and culture is pretty much dead. Okay? I'll do a couple of these, which is no more than the truth. It had been going on for a while. He was aware of it. But here's a little passage that applies to The Cocktail Party, which indeed is a play that is, on the surface, what it sounds like. Act one is a cocktail party. Act three is a cocktail party. Okay? By destroying traditional social habits of the people, by dissolving their natural collective consciousness into individual constituents, by licensing the opinions of the most foolish, by substituting instruction for education, by encouraging cleverness rather than wisdom, the upstart rather than the qualified, by fostering a notion of getting on, to which the alternative is a hopeless apathy, liberalism can prepare the way for that which is its own negation, the artificial, mechanized, or brutalized control, which is a desperate remedy for its chaos. As everything comes apart because of the deliberate dissolution of culture, then liberalism is forced to come in and put the clamps down on the chaos. He goes on that. Liberalism's movement is controlled rather by its origin than by any goal. It loses force after a series of rejections, and with nothing to destroy is left with nothing to uphold and with nowhere to go. Once liberalism has finally destroyed everything, then it has no purpose. It has no purpose at all. It doesn't know what to do. That's why, you know, it's got to come up with crackpot schemes like gay marriage and, you know, transsexualism, as I said, you know, children of five being encouraged to choose which sex they want to be. I mean, that's the end. That's beyond the end. That's just because they don't know what else to do, you know, other than soon you'll be able to. Well, Dianera could have married the horse, I guess. I don't know. It's where does this madness end? There's a Supreme Court hearing on gay marriage, which makes no sense because anyway. And one of the justices asked the lunatic female attorney supporting all this, well, okay, so you say this should go on, but then what happens if two men want to marry two women? What happens if four people want to get married? And she says, well, that can't happen because it's not traditional. And he had the good sense to say, well, you know, if you're going to use that as an argument, tradition for a long while has sort of been one man marrying one woman. And she said, well, now that has to change. Well, then why can't it change to be two men and two women Well, because we're not ready for it yet. Idiocy. Imbecility. You know, just at that point, all nine justices should have gone and just gotten up and walked out. But we've reached the point where people can talk like absolute lunatics and get away with it and be taken seriously. You know, no, from now on, the response when you get in an argument with a liberal, your response should be, or the wonderful thing I taught you the other day, which is, okay, the deaf sign for BS. You know, that's the only possible response. You don't talk to these people. You don't argue with them. They're nuts. You institutionalize them, which is what they deserve. Now, the cocktail party, Act One, I'm just going to... It's just wonderful. People were shocked. The Wemberleys were reading it as they drove here, okay? And Peter said to me, and it's absolutely true, it's what people were stunned by. He read Act One, he said, it's like a Noel Coward play. It's uproariously funny. It's like a drawing room comedy. It's filled with wit and uproariously funny characters. And you wonder, this is T.S. Eliot? Which is what many people said. This is T.S. Eliot? I'll give you one little indication. The situation is this. We don't know when the play opens. There's a cocktail party going on, but just a few people. The real situation is... Edward's wife Lavinia, and they're hosting the cocktail party. Lavinia invited people and then walked out on him. So the husband is stuck there, and he's been trying to call people and say, the party's been canceled. No, my wife can't be. So we've canceled the party. But there's a handful he can't reach, and they show up anyway. So he has to pretend to have a party while he's in this miserable state. And then, as I said, this mysterious guest shows up. The other people don't know him. Edward doesn't know him. He assumes it's a guest of the wife. Nobody knows what's going on. But it begins with just chitter-chatter, okay? A dotty old woman named Julia, who's delightful. A guy named Alex, who's a world traveler, who knows everybody and everything. A young girl named Celia, who turns out to be having an affair with the host. All of a sudden, the deeper rot comes to be exposed. But at the beginning, just like, I love this a little bit. By the way, Eliot adapts his four-beat line from the quartets, eases it up a little, and creates a three-beat line in the verse in the drama, in the stage drama. Two beats on one side of a caesura, pause in line, one beat on the other. And so it sounds like, the reason it sounds like speech is he's created a verse form that imitates human speech. So it sounds like, this is the very beginning. I'll just do this for the sake. You've missed the point completely, Julia. There were no tigers. That was the point. Okay, you've missed the point completely, Julia. You've missed the point completely, Julia. There were no tigers. That was the point. We got three beats there. But it doesn't sound like it unless you're aware of it, okay? Well, Julia starts telling stories about other people she knows, okay? It's cocktail party chit-chat. Do you know Delia Verinder? Delia Verinder, was she the one who had three brothers? Okay, how many brothers? Two, I think. No, there were three, but you wouldn't know the third one. They kept him rather quiet. Oh, you mean that one? He was feeble-minded. Oh, not feeble-minded. He was only harmless. Well, then, harmless. He was very clever at repairing clocks and a remarkable sense of hearing. The only man I ever met who could hear the cry of bats. He could hear the cry of bats. But how do you know he could hear the cry of bats? Because he said so, and I believed him. But if he was so harmless, how could you believe him? He might have imagined it. My darling Celia, you needn't be so skeptical. I stared there once at their castle in the north. How he suffered. They had to find an island for him where there were no bats. This is T.S. Eliot? This is Eliot? And it goes on. It's quite funny. You get wonderful actors in it. It's uproariously funny. And then Edward's making up excuses. Lavinia, she has a sick aunt down in the country, so she's gone down to stay. Well, which aunt? Where in the country? And it's very clear he's just making the whole thing up. You know, which Eliot steals from The Importance of Being Earnest. Algernon going bunburying down in the country, and there's no bunbury, he's got no friend down there. Okay, so he's taking from Noel Coward, he's taking from Oscar Wilde, he's working out of a light-hearted English comic tradition. And the play is a comedy. Here's something very interesting. There have been a number of very fine Catholic writers, those who had the faith, Evelyn Waugh, Flannery O'Connor, Walker Percy, T.S. Eliot. When they write, they tend to write comedies. Eliot, at the end of his career, turns to comedies. They cannot write grand tragedies or grand tragic stories for the simple fact that we can't have tragedy now. To have tragedy, you have to have hierarchy. We have no hierarchy. We have no sense of some sort of gradation in classes or the way society operates. You have to have grandeur, nobility, heroism. In this world, forget it. The reason they all write comedy is we've been reduced to the status of really pretty poor, pathetic little creatures just stumbling around trying to figure out what to do, how to get along with each other, how to survive. As the play says, it's in the wasteland, it shows up here too. Each locked in his own prison, rattling the cages a little bit, or maybe hoping somebody will help us unlock the door, or seeking some sort of sensual enjoyment in the world. The first temptation of Thomas in Murder in the Cathedral, okay? Or power, the second temptation. Or joining a rebel group. We're going to reform society and overturn everything and make a perfect world and life will be good. Yeah, sure you are. Go ahead. Thanks. It's been tried before recently with not real happy results. So what can we be? And what comedy is about is accommodating oneself so one can survive with a measure of happiness in the world. That's the best we can do, okay? Well, finally the others leave, although they keep breaking back in. And Edward is saying to the unidentified guest, well, I guess I can tell you the truth. I don't even know who you are. It's easier to talk to a stranger. And he says, my wife left me. The guest says, I know she did. I can bring her back. He says, what? You know, I can bring her back. Well, how do I get her back? You wait. And once again, principal theme of Eliot in the last part, you wait. And then you'll get a call. I'll tell you what to do. Well, then Celia returns. We find out they've been having an affair. The whole thing is just, then we find out the wife has been having an affair. It's, you know, it's the modern world. It's just muck. Just a total mess. Second act, we go to the office of the guest who seems to be a psychiatrist. Except he can't be because the attack on Freud is uproarious. Let's just say he seems to be a counselor, an advisor. People come to see him, and he sends them to what he calls his sanatorium, where maybe they can be healed a bit, but it's not. Well, anyway, we're not sure what it is. Here, Edward comes to talk to him and assumes he's a psychiatrist and says, well, I guess I need to tell you about my past. I remember in my childhood, and Riley, who the name of the guest, says, I always begin from the immediate situation and then go back as far as I find necessary. You see, your memories of childhood, I mean in your present state of mind, would be largely fictitious. And as for your dreams, you would produce amazing dreams to oblige me. I could make you dream any kind of dream I suggested, and would only go to flatter your vanity with the temporary stimulus of feeling interesting. Freudian psychology just dismissed in one speech. Just absolute nonsense. By the way, earlier, Eliot dismisses Jean-Paul Sartre in one little speech. There we go. And Lavinia shows up again. And they're having a fight. Immediately they start going at each other. And Edward finally in despair, and a kind of talks about himself and says, there was a door and I could not open it. I could not touch the handle. Why could I not walk out of my prison? What is hell? Hell is oneself. Hell is alone. The other figures in it, merely projections. There is nothing to escape from and nothing to escape to. One is always alone. Sartre had just written a play the year before called No Exit. Three people who are in hell together. Of course, he didn't believe in hell, so it's a phony little construct. But in which he comes up with the observation, hell is other people. And these three people who have not gotten along have to spend eternity together because two of them drive the third crazy and will do so forever. Hell is other people. Notice, please, it's what Eliot talked about earlier. It's the liberal vision. If there's a problem, it's out there. If I've got a problem, you're the problem. And especially if I've got a problem, you're all the problem. There's nothing wrong with me. Eliot comes right back with this, and it's wonderful. Hell is oneself. Hell is alone. You want to find out where the problem is? Look inside. Look inside. That's where you're going to find the problem. Dismisses Sartre, dismisses Freud. He was not a man of his age. Okay. Now, Edward and Lavinia go to see Riley, the counselor, and he, in effect, cures them by pointing out to them that they're both fairly miserable people who are responsible for the situation they find themselves in, and that basically Lavinia is saying he could not love any woman. He's incapable of love. And Edward's been saying no man could love her. And Riley says, now just turn it around. Okay, just assume he can't love any woman except Lavinia, except me. And Edward's saying, no one could love her except, I guess I could try. And Lavinia says, what? Well, is this what we're supposed to do? And Riley says, you have answered your own question, though you do not know the meaning of what you have said. Lavinia, we must make the best of a bad job. That is what he means. We've made a mess of this. It's pretty bad. Now we make the best of it and continue. Riley says, when you find, Mr. Chamberlain, that the best of a bad job is all any of us make of it, except, of course, the saints, such as those who go to the sanatorium, you will forget this phrase. Okay? Now, and they sort of go off taking a deep breath and saying, well, okay, I guess this is it. We'll do what we can. And then Celia shows up, the one who's had the affair, who has been summoned by Riley as well, and she's sort of surprised, oh, it's the unexpected guest that was at the party. And now we go to another level altogether. I'm going to read some of this. You would hear nothing like this on the stage anywhere else in the 20th century. He starts talking to her and she says, well, yeah, there are things wrong with me. There are two things I can't understand, which you might consider symptoms. But first I must tell you that I should really like to think there's something wrong with me. Because if there isn't, then there's something wrong, or at least very different from what it seemed to be, with the world itself. And that's much more frightening. It's not blaming others in the world. It's a sense of something's really wrong. That would be terrible. So I'd rather believe there's something wrong with me that could be put right. I've understood that I've always been alone. Always is alone, not simply the ending of one relationship or even simply finding it never existed, but a revelation about my relationship with everybody. Do you know, it no longer seems worthwhile to speak to anyone? They make noises and they think they are talking to each other. They make faces and they think they understand each other. And I'm sure that they don't. Is that a delusion? He says, no, it's quite accurate. And she says, what's your second symptom? Well, that's stranger still. It sounds ridiculous. But the only word for it that I can find is a sense of sin. You suffer from a sense of sin, Miss Copplestone? That is most unusual. It seemed to me abnormal, she says. We have yet to find out what would be normal for you before we use the term abnormal. Tell me what you mean by a sense of sin. Well, I suppose it's being immoral, and I don't feel as if I was immoral. In fact, aren't the people one thinks of as immoral just the people who we say have no moral sense? I've never noticed that immorality was accompanied by a sense of sin. Those who are doing awful things in the world have no sense of sin at all and no interest in it. It's just, okay. It's not the feeling of anything I've ever done, which I might get away from, or of anything in me I could get rid of, but of emptiness, of failure towards someone or something outside of myself. And I feel I must atone. Is that the word? Can you treat a patient for such a state of mind? Things that she needs to make up for because of a violation to someone or something out there beyond the self. Well, we know what these are stirrings. These are stirrings. Eliot has got to be talking about something that happened in him years ago when he discovered the truths of the faith that finally allowed him to understand what was going on in the world. Can you cure me, she asks. And then comes one of the greatest speeches in all of drama. And all of a sudden, Eliot makes the point. You disguise from the audience that they're listening to poetry, and then when you ratchet it up a degree, their ear will be attuned, and they still won't know they're listening to poetry, but they'll be captured by the rhythms and the language and have a sense they're hearing something a bit higher than what they've heard before. I can't describe to you how I love this speech. Can you cure me, she says. The condition is curable, but the form of treatment must be your own choice. I cannot choose for you. If that is what you wish, I can reconcile you to the human condition, the condition to which some who have gone as far as you have succeeded in returning. They may remember the vision they have had, but they cease to regret it, maintain themselves by the common routine, learn to avoid excessive expectation, become tolerant of themselves and others, giving and taking in the usual actions what there is to give and take. They do not repine, are contented with the morning that separates and with the evening that brings together for casual talk before the fire, two people who know they do not understand each other, breeding children whom they do not understand and who will never understand them. Is that the truth or what? Celia, is that the best life? It is a good life, though you will not know how good till you come to the end. But you will want nothing else, and the other life will be only like a book you have read once and lost. In a world of lunacy, violence, stupidity, greed, it is a good life. Singing the praises of just living a decent, common, day-to-day life. The gift that people had in the medieval world that's been lost, that can now only be recovered through effort and a genuine attempt to understand the ultimate principles of faith that can give us the only hope we have for a regular, decent, it is a good life, he says. It is a good life. Celia says, well, I might be able to accept that if I might still have it, yet it leaves me cold. She wants something more. What Eliot is describing here is two paths. One that most must follow. And yet we know there are people out there who somehow need more, have to go beyond that, cannot be satisfied. There is another way if you have the courage. The first I could describe in familiar terms because you have seen it, as we have all seen it, illustrated more or less in lives of those about us. The second is unknown and so requires faith, the kind of faith that issues from despair. The destination cannot be described. You will know very little until you get there. You will journey blind, but the way leads towards possession of what you sought for in the wrong place. Don't know where you're going. Don't know what will happen. She says, that's what I want. And he sends her off. And the play resolves in Act 3, and I'm not going to say a word about it. Act 3 is another cocktail party. This is called Make You Read It. My suggestion is get together with some friends, get some copies of the play, read it aloud one night. You couldn't spend your time any better. I've been lucky enough to... Look, a cat came in. It's a sign. It's a sign. That is absolutely astonishing. Oh, man. Oh, I love it. Oh, well, so forgive me. I have to... How much time do I have? That ain't much, but I'm going to do this anyway. I have to do this. I wasn't going to. This is the last of the cat poems called The Addressing of Cats. You've read of several kinds of cat, and my opinion now is that you should need no interpreter to understand their character. You now have learned enough to see that cats are much like you and me, and other people whom we find possessed of various types of mind. For some are sane, and some are mad, and some are good, and some are bad, and some are better, some are worse, but all may be described in verse. You've seen them both at work and games, and learnt about their proper names, their habits and their habitat, but how would you address a cat? So first your memory I'll jog, and say a cat is not a dog. Now dogs pretend they like to fight, they often bark, more seldom bite, but yet a dog is on the whole what you would call a simple soul. Of course, I'm not including peaks and some fantastic canine freaks. The usual dog about the town is much inclined to play the clown, and far from showing too much pride, is frequently undignified. He's very easily taken in. Just chuck him underneath the chin, or slap his back, or shake his paw, and he will gamble and guffaw. He's such an easygoing lout, he'll answer any hail or shout. Again, I must remind you that a dog's a dog. A cat's a cat. With cats, some say, one rule is true. Don't speak till you are spoken to. Myself, I do not hold with that. I say you should address a cat. But always keep in mind that he resents familiarity. I bow, and taking off my hat, address him in this form, O cat. And if he is the cat next door, whom I have often met before, he comes to see me in my flat. I greet him with an oops-a-cat. I've heard them call him James Buzz James, but we've never got so far as names. Before a cat will condescend to treat you as a trusted friend, some little token of esteem is needed, like a dish of cream. And you might now and then supply some caviar or Strasbourg pie, some potted grouse or salmon paste. He's sure to have his personal taste. I know a cat who makes a habit of eating nothing else but rabbit, and when he's finished, licks his paws so not to waste the onion sauce. A cat's entitled to expect these evidence of respect, and so in time you reach your aim and finally call him by his name. And this is this, and that is that, and there is how you address a cat. So, It's unbelievable. It's absolutely unbelievable. It's simply wonderful. All right. I can't see it. How much is left? 10. Oh, 10. All right, that's good. Well, all right. I've been lucky enough to see all 5 of the Elliott plays on stage. They're wonderful. I hadn't seen the cocktail party, so I did it myself. I got the community theater in Annapolis, Maryland, allow me to do it. Got to work on it for months. I had a wonderful cast. It's a stupendous play. It ran for a year on Broadway, starring Sir Alec Guinness. Won the Tony Award for Best Play of the Year. Came to London, had a long run. It was just revived off-Broadway a couple years ago, and all the critics said, gee, this is an interesting play. All those other hit plays of the time in London are, you know, dated and gone away. This is a very interesting play. It will grow and grow and grow. It's who we are. It tells us very quickly, because I have little time left. The last thing he wrote is called The Elder Statesman. In 1957, Eliot fell in love again. He was 69 years old. He'd hired a new young secretary named Valerie Fletcher, who was in her late 20s. They announced they were going to be married. His friends thought he'd gone mad. They married, and the man who had endured one of the most unhappy marriages in human history ended his days in one of the happiest marriages that ever took place. They were deliriously happy. And their days, those last days that they spent together, from 57 until his death in 1965, unrelieved happiness. The last play, The Elder Statesman, is about a very highly acclaimed politician who thinks he's been a fraud. It's Eliot very clearly, with his guilt, thinking, I didn't deserve the honors. And the old man is about to, he's retired, in his life, and suddenly from his past, two figures appear whom he wronged years ago, that he thought he had just put in the memory bank. They're back, and he has to deal with them. It's a wonderful play. It resolves itself, and it resolves itself because of love. Nothing Eliot ever wrote uses the word love more often than The Elder Statesman. And the ending is positively overwhelming. It's based on Sophocles' Oedipus at Colonus, where at the end the old Oedipus, who's been led by his daughters, simply wanders off under a tree and dies, but it seems to be a miraculous occurrence. Here, the father wanders off to rest under a beech tree, and we know we won't see him again. And his daughter and her fiancé are talking, and she sees him go and doesn't need to follow him because it's all right. He knows how much she loves him. She has expressed her love. And she turns to her fiancé because the love passes. Real love passes if it's based on charity, forgiveness. And the final words he wrote in this last play, his daughter Monica says, age and decrepitude can have no terrors for me. Loss and vicissitude cannot appall me. Not even death can dismay or amaze me, fixed in the certainty of love unchanging. But to be fixed in that certainty of love unchanging, it must first be fixed in the highest love that we know will not change. And then there's the chance that we can find a measure of it on this earth as Eliot did. How much have I got left? Five. I can do this then. I just want to end with this. It's the last long poem that Eliot published in 1954. It's the wrong season for it, but I want to introduce you to it. You can find it on the internet. When it comes Christmas time again, get it out and read it. I'll read it, and then it's not terribly long, just a couple of minutes. It's called The Cultivation of Christmas Trees. There are several attitudes towards Christmas, some of which we may disregard: the social, the torpid, the patently commercial, the rowdy, the pubs being open till midnight, and the childish, which is not that of the child, for whom the candle is a star. And the gilded angel spreading its wings at the summit of the tree is not only a decoration, but an angel. The child wonders at the Christmas tree. Let him continue in the spirit of wonder at the feast as an event, not accepted as a pretext, so that the glittering rapture, the amazement of the first remembered Christmas tree, so that the surprises, delight in new possessions, each one with its peculiar and exciting smell, the expectation of the goose or turkey, and the expected awe on its appearance, so that the reverence and the gaiety may not be forgotten in later experience, in the bored habituation, the fatigue, the tedium, the awareness of death, the consciousness of failure, or in the piety of the convert, which may be tainted with a self-conceit displeasing to God and disrespectful to the children. And here I remember also with gratitude St. Lucy, her carol, and her crown of fire. So that before the end, the 80th Christmas, by 80th meaning whichever is the last, the accumulated memories of annual emotion may be concentrated into a great joy, which shall be also a great fear, as on that occasion when fear came upon every soul, because the beginning shall remind us of the end, and the first coming of the second coming. It's a beautiful poem. Please notice, he recaptured some of the joy of childhood. He became a child again, and then was given a perfect marriage, and made a very quiet death, with his wife holding his hand. He's buried in East Coker, where his ancestors set sail from. And there's a little plaque there above his remains, which simply says, "In my beginning is my end." He returned to where the family started out. "In your charity, pray for the repose of the soul of Thomas Stearns Eliot, poet." And by gum, he was. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Doctor.
You're quite welcome, man. Your Excellency.